psychic blindness. A quite different sort of visual shutdown, a withdrawal, seemed to be associated with situations of great emotional stress or conflict. And for Virgil, this period was indeed as stressful a time as he had ever known. He had just had surgery. He had just been married. The even tenor of his blind bachelor life had been shattered. He was under a tremendous pressure of expectation, and seeing itself was confusing, exhausting. These pressures had increased as his wedding day approached, especially with the convergence of his own family in town. His family had not only opposed the surgery in the first place, but now insisted that he was in fact still blind. All this was documented by Amy in her journal. October 9th. Went to church to decorate for wedding. Virgil's vision quite blurry. Not able to distinguish much. It is as though sight has taken a nosedive. Virgil acting blind again. Having me lead him around. October 11th. Virgil's family arrives today. His sight seems to have gone on vacation. It is as though he has gone back to being blind. Family arrived, couldn't believe he could see. Every time he said he could see something, they would say, "Ah, you're just guessing." They treated him as though he was totally blind, leading him around, giving him anything he wanted. I am very nervous, and Virgil's sight has disappeared. Want to be sure we are doing the right thing. October 12th. Wedding day. Virgil very calm. Vision little clearer, but still blurry. Could see me coming down aisle, but was very blurry. Wedding beautiful. Party at Mom's. Virgil surrounded by family. They still cannot accept his sight. He could not see much. Said goodbye to his family tonight. Sight began clearing up right after they left. In these episodes, Virgil was treated by his family as a blind man. His seeing identity denied or undermined, and he responded compliantly by acting or even becoming blind. A massive withdrawal or regression of part of his ego to a crushing, annihilating denial of identity. Such a regression would have to be seen as motivated, albeit unconsciously. An inhibition on a functional basis. Thus there seem to be two distinct forms of blind behavior, or acting blind. One, a collapse of visual processing and visual identity on an organic basis, a bottom-up or neuropsychological disturbance in neurological parlance. The other, a collapse or inhibition of visual identity on a functional basis, a top-down or psychoneurotic disturbance. Though no less real for him. Given the extreme organic weakness of his vision, the instability of his visual systems and visual identity at this point, it was very difficult at times to know what was going on, to distinguish between the physiological and psychological. His vision was so marginal, so close to the border, that either neural overload or identity conflict might push him over it. Marius von Sanden, reviewing every published case over a 300-year period in his classic book Space and Sight, 1932, concluded that every newly sighted adult sooner or later comes to a motivation crisis, and that not every patient gets through it. He tells of one patient who felt so threatened by sight, which would have meant his leaving the asylum for the blind and his fiancée there, that he threatened to tear his eyes out. He cites case after case of patients who behave blind or refuse to see after an operation, and of others who, fearful of what sight may entail, refuse operation. Both Gregory and Valvo dilate on the emotional dangers of forcing a new sense on a blind man. How, after an initial exhilaration, a devastating and even lethal depression can ensue. Precisely such a depression descended on Gregory's patient. Espy's period in the hospital was full of excitement and perceptual progress, but the promise was not fulfilled. 6 months after the operation, Gregory reports, "We formed a strong impression that his sight was to him almost entirely disappointing. It enabled him to do a little more, but it became clear that the opportunities it afforded him were less than he had imagined. He still, to a great extent, lived the life of a blind man, sometimes not bothering to put on the light at night. He did not get on well with his neighbors now, who regarded him as odd, and his workmates, previously so admiring, played tricks on him and teased him for being unable to read. His depression deepened, he became ill, and 2 years after his operation, S.B. died. He had been perfectly healthy. He had once enjoyed life. He was only 54. Valvo provides us with 6 exemplary tales and a profound discussion of the feelings and behavior of early blinded people when they are confronted with the gift of sight and with the necessity of renouncing one world, one identity, for another. A major conflict in Virgil, as in all newly sighted people, was the uneasy relation of touch and sight, not knowing whether to feel or look. This was obvious in Virgil from the day of the operation, and was very evident the day we saw him, when he could hardly keep his hands off the form board, longed to touch all the animals, and gave up spearing his food. His vocabulary, his whole sensibility, his picture of the world were couched in tactile, or at least non-visual terms. He was, or had been until his operation, a touch person through and through. It has been well established that in congenitally deaf people, especially if they are native signers, some of the auditory parts of the brain are reallocated for visual use. It has also been well established that in blind people who read Braille, the reading finger has an exceptionally large representation in the tactile parts of the cerebral cortex. And one would suspect that the tactile and auditory parts of the cortex are enlarged in the blind and may even extend into what is normally the visual cortex. What remains of the visual cortex without visual stimulation may be largely undeveloped. It seems likely that such a differentiation of cerebral development would follow the early loss of a sense and the compensatory enhancement of other senses. If this was the case in Virgil, what might happen if visual function was suddenly made possible, demanded? One might certainly expect some visual learning, some development of new pathways in the visual parts of the brain. There had never been any documentation of the kindling of activity in the visual cortex of an adult, and we hoped to take special PET scans of Virgil's visual cortex to show this as he learned to see. But what would this learning, this activation, be like? Would it be like a baby first learning to see? This was Amy's first thought. But the newly sighted are not on the same starting line, neurologically speaking, as babies, whose cerebral cortex is equipotential, equally ready to adapt to any form of perception. The cortex of an early blinded adult, such as Virgil, has already become highly adapted to organizing perceptions in time and not in space. An infant merely learns. This is a huge, never-ending task. But it is not one charged with irresolvable conflict. A newly sighted adult, by contrast, has to make a radical switch from a sequential to a visual-spatial mode. And such a switch flies in the face of the experience of an entire lifetime. Gregory emphasizes this, pointing out how conflict and crisis are inevitable if the perceptual habits and strategies of a lifetime are to be changed. Such conflicts are built into the nature of the nervous system itself. For the early blinded adult who has spent a lifetime adapting and specializing his brain must now ask his brain to reverse all this. Moreover, the brain of an adult no longer has the plasticity of a child's brain. That is why learning new languages or new skills becomes more difficult with age. But in the case of a man previously blind, learning to see is not like learning another language. It is, as Diderot puts it, like learning language for the first time. In the newly sighted, learning to see demands a radical change in neurological functioning, and with it, a radical change in psychological functioning, in self, in identity. The change may be experienced in literally life and death terms. Valvo quotes a patient of his as saying, "One must die as a sighted person to be born again as a blind person." And the opposite is equally true. One must die as a blind person to be born again as a seeing person. It is the interim, the limbo, between two worlds, one dead, the other powerless to be born, that is so terrible. Though blindness may at first be a terrible privation and loss, it may become less so with the passage of time, for a deep adaptation or reorientation occurs, by which one reconstitutes, reappropriates the world in non-visual terms. It then becomes a different condition, a different form of being, one with its own sensibilities and coherence and feeling. John Hall calls this deep blindness, and sees it as one of the orders of human being. On October 31st, the cataract in Virgil's left eye was removed, revealing a retina, an acuity, similar to the right. This was a great disappointment, for there had been hope that it might be a far better eye, enough to make a crucial difference to his vision. His vision did improve slightly. He fixated better, and the searching eye movements were fewer, and he had a larger visual field. With both eyes working, Virgil now went back to work, but found, increasingly, that there was another side to seeing, that much of it was confusing and some downright shocking. He had worked happily at the Y for 30 years, he said, and thought he knew all the bodies of his clients. Now he found himself startled by seeing bodies and skins that he had previously known only by touch. He was amazed at the range of skin colors he saw, and slightly disgusted by blemishes and stains in skin that to his hands had seemed perfectly smooth. Virgil found it a relief when giving massages to shut his eyes. He continued to improve visually over the ensuing weeks, especially when he was free to set his own pace. He did his utmost to live the life of a sighted man, but he also became more conflicted at this time. He expressed fears, occasionally, that he would have to throw away his cane and walk outside, cross the streets by vision alone, and on one occasion a fear that he might be expected to drive and take up an entirely new sighted job. This, then, was a time of great striving and real success. But success achieved, one felt, at a psychological cost, at a cost of deepening strain and splitting in himself. There was one outing a week before Christmas, when he and Amy went to the ballet. Virgil enjoyed the Nutcracker. He had always loved the music, and now, for the first time, he saw something as well. "I could see people jumping around the stage. Couldn't see what they were wearing, though," he said. He thought he would enjoy seeing a live baseball game, and looked forward to the start of the season in the spring. Christmas was a particularly festive and important time, the first Christmas after his wedding, his first Christmas as a sighted man, and he returned with Amy to the family farm in Kentucky. He saw his mother for the first time in more than 40 years. He had scarcely been able to see her, to see anything much at the time of the wedding, and thought she looked real pretty. He saw again the old farmhouse, the fences, the creek and the pasture, which he had also not seen since he was a child. He had never ceased to cherish them in his mind. Some of his seeing had been a great disappointment, but seeing home and family was not. It was a pure joy. No less important was the change in the family's attitude toward him. He seemed more alert, his sister said. He would walk, move around the house, without touching the walls. He would just get up and go. She felt that there had been a big difference since he was first operated on, and his mother and the rest of the family felt the same. I phoned them the day before Christmas and spoke to his mother, his sister, and others. They asked me to join them, and I wish I could have done so, for it seemed to be a joyful and affirmative time for them all. The family's initial opposition to Virgil seeing, and perhaps to Amy, too, for having pushed it, and their disbelief that he could actually see, had been something that he internalized, something that could literally annihilate his seeing. Now that the family was converted, a major psychological block, one hoped, might dissolve. Christmas was the climax, but also the resolution of an extraordinary year. What would happen, I wondered, in the coming year? What might he hope for at best? How much of a visual world, a visual life, might still await him? We were frankly quite unsure at this point. Grim and frightening though the histories of so many patients were, some at least overcame the worst of their difficulties and emerged into a relatively unconflicted new sight. Valvo, normally cautious in expression, lets himself go a little in describing some of his patients' happier outcomes. Once our patients acquire visual patterns and can work with them autonomously, they seem to experience great joy in visual learning, a renaissance of personality. They start thinking about wholly new areas of experience. A renaissance of personality. This was just what Amy wanted for Virgil. It was difficult for us to imagine such a renaissance in him, for he seemed so phlegmatic, so set in his ways. And yet, despite a range of problems, retinal, cortical, psychological, possibly medical, he had done remarkably well in a way, had shown a steady increase in his power to apprehend a visual world. With his predominantly positive motivation, and the obvious enjoyment and advantage he could get from seeing, there seemed no reason why he should not progress further. He could never hope to have perfect vision, but he might certainly hope for a life radically enlarged by seeing. The catastrophe, when it came, was very sudden. On February 8th, I had a phone call from Amy. Virgil had collapsed, had been taken, gray and stuporous, to the hospital. He had a lobar pneumonia, a massive consolidation of one lung, and was in the intensive care unit on oxygen and intravenous antibiotics. The first antibiotics used did not work. He grew worse, he grew critical, and for some days he hovered between life and death. Then, after 3 weeks, the infection was finally mastered, and the lung started to re-expand. But Virgil himself remained gravely ill, for though the pneumonia itself was clearing, it had tipped him into respiratory failure. A near paralysis of the respiratory center in the brain, which made it unable to respond properly to levels of oxygen and carbon dioxide in the blood. The oxygen levels in his blood started to fell to less than half of normal, and the level of carbon dioxide started to rose to nearly 3 times normal. He needed oxygen constantly, but only a little could be given, lest his failing respiratory center be further depressed. With his brain deprived of oxygen and poisoned by carbon dioxide, Virgil's consciousness fluctuated and faded, and on bad days, when the oxygen in his blood was lowest and the carbon dioxide highest, he could see nothing. He was totally blind. Much contributed to this continuing respiratory crisis. Virgil's lungs themselves were thickened and fibrotic. There was advanced bronchitis and emphysema. There was no movement of the diaphragm on one side, a consequence of his childhood polio, And on top of all this, he was enormously obese, obese enough to cause a Pickwick syndrome, named after the somnolent fat boy Joe in the Pickwick Papers. In Pickwick syndrome, there is a grave depression of breathing and failure to oxygenate the blood fully, associated with a depression of the respiratory center in the brain. Virgil had probably been getting ill for some years. He had gradually been increasing in weight since 1985, but between his wedding and Christmas, he had put on a further 40 pounds, had shot up in a few weeks to 280 pounds, partly from fluid retention caused by heart failure, and partly from nonstop eating, a habit of his under stress. He now had to spend 3 weeks in the hospital, his blood oxygen still plummeting to dangerously low levels, despite his being given oxygen. And each time the level grew really low, he became lethargic and totally blind. Amy would know the moment she opened his door what sort of day he was having, where the blood oxygen was, depending on whether he used his eyes, looked around, or fumbled and touched, acted blind. We wondered in retrospect whether the strange fluctuations his vision had shown from almost the day of surgery might also have been caused, at least in part, by fluctuations in his blood oxygen, with consequent retinal or cerebral anoxia. Virgil had probably had a mild Pickwick syndrome for years, and could have been close to respiratory failure and anoxia even before his acute illness. There was another intermediate state, which Amy found very puzzling. At such times he would say that he saw nothing whatever, but would reach for objects, avoid obstacles, and behave as if seeing. Amy could make nothing of this singular state, in which he manifestly responded to objects, could locate them, was seeing, and yet denied any consciousness of seeing. This condition, called implicit sight, unconscious sight or blind sight, occurs if the visual parts of the cerebral cortex are knocked out, as they may be by a lack of oxygen, for instance, but the visual centers in the subcortex remain intact. Visual signals are perceived and are responded to appropriately, but nothing of this perception reaches consciousness at all. At last, Virgil was able to leave the hospital and return home, but to return a respiratory cripple. He was tethered to an oxygen cylinder and could not even stir from his chair without it. It seemed unlikely at this stage that he would ever recover sufficiently to go out and work again, and the Y now felt that it had to terminate his job. A few months later, he was forced to leave the house where he had lived as an employee of the Y for more than 20 years. This was the situation that summer. Virgil had lost not only his health, but his job and his house as well. By October, however, he was feeling better and was able to go without oxygen for an hour or two at a time. It had not been wholly clear to me, from speaking to Virgil and Amy, what had finally happened to his vision after all these months. Amy said that it had almost gone, but that now she felt it was coming back as he got better. When I phoned the Visual Rehabilitation Center where Virgil had been evaluated, I was given a different story. Virgil, I was told, seemed to have lost all the sight restored the previous year, with only a few bits remaining. Kathy, his therapist, thought he saw colors but little else, and sometimes colors without objects. Thus he might see a haze or a halo of pink around a Pepto-Bismol bottle without clearly seeing the bottle itself. This color perception, she said, was the only seeing that was constant. For the rest, he appeared almost blind, missed objects, groped, seemed visually lost. He was showing his old, blind, random movements of the eyes. And yet, sometimes, spontaneously, out of the blue, he would get sudden, startling moments of vision, in which he would see objects, quite small ones. But these percepts would then vanish as suddenly as they came, and he was usually unable to retrieve them. For all practical purposes, she said, Virgil was now blind. I was shocked and puzzled when Kathy told me this. These were phenomena radically different from anything he had shown before. What was happening now with his eyes and his brain? From a distance, I could not sort out what was happening, especially since Amy, for her part, maintained that Virgil's vision was now improving. Indeed, she got furious when she heard anyone say that Virgil was blind, and she maintained that the Visual Rehab Center was actually teaching him to be blind. So, in February of 1993, a year after the onset of his devastating illness, we brought Virgil and Amy to New York to see us again and to get some specialized physiological tests of retinal and brain function. As soon as I met Virgil at the arrival gate at LaGuardia Airport, I could see for myself that everything had gone quite terribly wrong. He was now almost 50 pounds heavier than when I had met him in Oklahoma. He was carrying a cylinder of oxygen strung over one shoulder. He groped. His eyes wandered. He looked totally blind. Amy guided him, her hand under his elbow, everywhere they went. And yet sometimes, as we drove over the 59th Street Bridge into the city, he would pick up something, a light on the bridge, not guessing, but seeing it quite accurately. But he could never hold it or retrieve it, and so remained visually lost. When we came to test him in my office, first using large colored targets, then large movements and flashlights, he missed everything. He seemed totally blind, blinder than he had been before his operations. Because then, at least, even through his cataracts, he could consistently detect light, its direction, and the shadow of a hand moving before him. Now he could detect nothing whatever. No longer seemed to have any light-sensitive receptors. It was as if his retinas had gone. Yet not totally gone, that was the odd thing. For once in a while he would see something accurately. Once he saw, described, grasped a banana. On two occasions he was able to follow a randomly moving light bar with his hands on a computer screen. And sometimes he would reach for objects, or guess them correctly, even though he said he saw nothing at such times. The blind sight that had first been observed in the hospital. We were dismayed at his near-uniform failure, and he was sinking into a demoralized, defeated state. It was time to stop testing and take a break for lunch. As we passed him a bowl of fruit, and he felt the fruit with swift, sensitive, skillful fingers, his face lighted up, and he regained his animation. He gave us, as he handled the fruit, remarkable tactile descriptions, speaking of the waxy, slick quality of the plum skin, the soft fuzz of peaches and smoothness of nectarines, like a baby's cheeks, and the rough, dimpled skin of oranges. He weighed the fruits in his hand, spoke of their weight and consistency, their pips and stones, and then, lifting them to his nose, their different smells. His tactile and olfactory appreciation seemed far finer than our own. We included an exceedingly clever wax pear among the real fruit. With its realistic shape and coloring, it had deceived sighted people completely. Virgil was not taken in for a moment. He burst out laughing as soon as he touched it. "It's a candle," he said immediately, somewhat puzzled. "Shaped like a bell or a pear." While he may indeed have been, in von Zenden's words, an exile from spatial reality, he was deeply at home in the world of touch, in time. But if his sense of touch was perfectly preserved, there were, it was evident, just sparks from his retinas. Rare, momentary sparks from retinas that now seemed to be 99% dead. Bob Wasserman, too, who had not seen Virgil since our visit to Oklahoma, was appalled at the degradation of vision and wanted to re-examine the retinas. When he did so, they looked exactly as before. Piebald, with areas of increased and decreased pigmentation. There was no evidence of any new disease. Yet the functioning of even the preserved areas of retina had fallen to almost zero. Electroretinograms, designed to record the retina's electrical activity when stimulated by light, were completely flat, and visual-evoked potentials, designed to show activity in the visual parts of the brain, were absent too. There was no longer anything electrically going on in either the retinas or the brain that could be recorded. There may have been rare, momentary sparks of activity, but if so, we failed to catch these in our recordings. This inactivity could not be attributed to the original disease, retinitis, which had long been inactive. Something else had emerged in the past year and had, in effect, extinguished his remaining retinal function. We remembered how Virgil had constantly complained of glare, even on relatively dull, overcast days, how glare seemed to blind him sometimes, so that he needed the darkest glasses. Was it possible, as my friend Kevin Halligan suggested, that with the removal of his cataracts, cataracts that had perhaps shielded his fragile retinas for decades, the ordinary light of day had proved lethal, burnt out his retinas? It is said that patients with other retinal problems, like macular degeneration, may be exceedingly intolerant of light, not merely ultraviolet, but light of all wavelengths, and that light may hasten the degeneration of their retinas. Was this what had happened with Virgil? It was one possibility. Should we have foreseen it and rationed Virgil's sight, or the ambient light in some way? Another possibility, a likelier one, related to Virgil's continuing hypoxia, the fact that he had not had properly oxygenated blood for a year. We had clear accounts of his vision waxing and waning in the hospital as his blood gases went up and down. Could the repeated or continuing oxygen starving of his retinas, and perhaps also of the visual areas of his cortex, have been the factor that did them in? It was wondered at this point whether raising blood oxygenation to 100%, which would have required sustained artificial respiration with pure oxygen, might restore some retinal or cerebral function. But it was decided that this procedure would be too risky, since it might cause long-term or permanent depression of the brain's respiratory center. This, then, is Virgil's story. The story of a miraculous restoration of sight to a blind man. A story basically similar to that of Cheselden's young patient in 1728, and of a handful of others over the past three centuries, but with a bizarre and ironic twist at the end. Gregory's patient, so well adapted to blindness before his operation, was first delighted with seeing, but soon encountered intolerable stresses and difficulties, found the gift transformed to a curse, became deeply depressed, and soon after died. Almost all the earlier patients, indeed, after their initial euphoria, were overwhelmed by the enormous difficulties of adapting to a new sense, though a very few, as Valvo stresses, have adapted and done well. Could Virgil have surmounted these difficulties and adapted to seeing where so many others had foundered on the way? We shall never know, for the business of adaptation, and indeed of life as he knew it, was suddenly cut across by a gratuitous blow of fate, an illness that at a single stroke deprived him of job, house, health, and independence, leaving him a gravely sick man, unable to fend for himself. For Amy, who incited the surgery in the first place, and who was so passionately invested in Virgil seeing, it was a miracle that misfired. A calamity. Virgil, for his part, maintains philosophically, these things happen. But he has been shattered by this blow, has given vent to outbursts of rage, rage at his helplessness and sickness, rage at the smashing of a promise and a dream. And beneath this, most fundamental of all, a rage that had been smoldering in him almost from the beginning. Rage at being thrust into a battle he could neither renounce nor win. At the beginning, there was certainly amazement, wonder, and sometimes joy. There was also, of course, great courage. It was an adventure, an excursion into a new world, the like of which is given to few. But then came the problems, the conflicts of seeing but not seeing, not being able to make a visual world, and at the same time being forced to give up his own. He found himself between two worlds, at home in neither, a torment from which no escape seemed possible. But then, paradoxically, a release was given in the form of a second and now final blindness, a blindness he received as a gift. Now, at last, Virgil is allowed to not see, allowed to escape from the glaring, confusing world of sight and space, and to return to his own true being, the intimate, concentrated world of the other senses that had been his home for almost 50 years. The landscape of his dreams. I first met Franco Magnani in the summer of 1988, when the Exploratorium in San Francisco held a symposium and an exhibit on memory. The exhibit included 50 paintings and drawings by him, all of Pontito, the little Tuscan hill town where he was born, but had not seen for more than 30 years. Next to them, in astounding apposition, were photographs of Pontito taken by the Exploratorium's photographer, Susan Schwarzenberg, from exactly the same viewpoints as Magnani's, wherever possible. This was not always possible because Magnani sometimes visualized and painted Pontito from an imaginary aerial viewpoint, 50 or 500 feet above the ground. Schwarzenberg sometimes had to hoist her camera aloft on a pole, and at one point thought of hiring a helicopter or a balloon. Magnani was billed as a memory artist, and one had only to glance at the exhibit to see that he indeed possessed a prodigious memory, a memory that could seemingly reproduce with almost photographic accuracy every building, every street, every stone of Pontito, far away, close up, from any possible angle. It was as if Magnani held in his head an infinitely detailed, three-dimensional model of his village, which he could turn around and examine or explore mentally, and then reproduce on canvas with total fidelity. My first thought when I saw the resemblance between the paintings and the photographs was that here was that rare phenomenon, an eidetic artist. An artist able to hold in memory, for hours or days, perhaps for years, an entire scene that had been glimpsed in a flash. The commander, or slave, of a prodigious native power of imagery and memory. But an eidetic artist would scarcely confine himself to a single theme or subject. On the contrary, he would exploit his memory, or display it in a huge range of subjects, to show that nothing lay beyond its grasp. Whereas Magnani seemingly wanted to concentrate it exclusively upon Pontito. This, then, was an exhibit not of pure memory, but of memory harnessed to a single overwhelming motive, the recollection of his childhood village. And I now realized it was not just an exercise in memory. It was equally an exercise in nostalgia. And not just an exercise, but a compulsion and an art. A few days later, I spoke to Franco and arranged to meet him at his house. He lives in a small community a few miles outside San Francisco. Once I had found his street, I did not need to look for his house number, because his house stood out immediately from its neighbors. In the small front yard was a low stone wall resembling those in his paintings of Pontito. His car, an aging sedan with vanity plates, Pontito, was parked in the street. The garage had been converted into a studio, and its door was wide open, revealing the artist himself, intently at work. Franco was tall and slim, with enormous horn-rimmed glasses that magnified his eyes. He had thick brown hair, carefully parted on one side, a springy stride, and an air of great exuberance and vitality. He was 54 but seemed much younger. He invited me in and showed me around his home. Every room had paintings on every wall, and every drawer and closet seemed stacked full of paintings. It was less like a house than a museum or archive, totally devoted to the recollection, the reproduction of Pontito. As we walked through the house, each painting arrested his attention, aroused a flood of reminiscence. What happened here, what there, and how so-and-so stood there once. Look at this wall here. That's where the priest, he caught me climbing to the garden behind the church. He chased me all the way down the street. Oh, he always chased all the kids away from there. Each reminiscence triggered others, and these still others, so that within minutes we were engulfed in a flood, without any clear direction or center, but all relating to his early life, to Pontito, as he had experienced it as a child. He leapt from one story to another without any connection that I could discern. This sort of rambling, single-minded and intense, but incoherent and unfocused, seemed characteristic of Franco. It showed the quality of his obsession, the fact that he thought of Pontito day and night, to the exclusion of all else. As Franco talked, I had the impression that his reminiscences were taking him over, that these upsurging memories drove him, dominated him, exerted a huge, irresistible force. He would gesture, he would mime, he would breathe heavily, he would glare. He seemed to be completely transported. Then, with a start, he would come back, smile a little embarrassedly, and say, "That's how it was." This non-stop verbosity, this reminiscence of concrete episodes, seemed to be in a quite different mode from his painting. When he was alone, he said, the yammer and clatter of memories would die down, and he would get a calm impression of Pontito. A Pontito without people, without incidents, without temporality. A Pontito at peace, suspended in a timeless once. The once of allegory, fantasy, myth, and fairy tale. By mid-morning I had been enthralled again by Franco's paintings, but had had enough of his reminiscences. He had one subject only, could talk of nothing else. What could be more sterile, more boring? Yet out of this obsession, he could create a lovely, real, and tranquil art. What was it that served to transform his memories, to remove them from the sphere of the personal, the trivial, the temporal, and bring them into the realm of the universal, the sacred? One encounters boring talkers, reminiscers, by the score, and not one of them will be a true artist like Franco. Thus it was not just his vast memory or his obsession that was crucial in making him an artist, but rather something much deeper. Franco was born in Pontito in 1934. A village of some 500 souls, it was nestled in the hills of Castelvecchio, in the province of Pistoia, about 40 miles west of Florence. Like all Tuscan hill villages, it had an ancient lineage and still had an abundance of Etruscan tombs, as well as traditional patterns of farming, terracing, and olive and vine growing, going back more than 2,000 years. Its stone buildings, its steep, winding streets, traversable only by trim mountain donkeys or human feet, had not changed in centuries, nor had the simple, orderly life of its residents. The village was dominated at its highest point by the spire of its ancient church. And Franco's house was next to the church, Indeed, as a child, he could nearly touch its roof if he leaned far enough out of his bedroom window. Somewhat isolated and inbred, the villagers formed almost a single large family. The Magnanis, the Papis, the Vanuccis, the Tamburis, the Sarpis were all related. The village's greatest eminence was Lazzaro Papi, an 18th-century commentator on the French Revolution. A monument to him still stands in the central square. Isolated, unchanging, traditional, Pontito was a citadel against the flux of change and time. The earth was fertile, the inhabitants industrious. Their farms and orchards sustained them without luxury or want. Life was good and secure for Franco, for all the villagers, until the outbreak of the war. But then came horrors and troubles of every kind. Franco's father died in an accident in 1942, and the following year saw the entry of the Nazis, who took over the village and evicted the townspeople. When the villagers came back, many of their houses had been defaced. Life was never the same after this. The town had been despoiled, the fields and the orchards had been ruined, and perhaps most important, the old patterns and mores disturbed. Pontito gathered itself together and tried gallantly to recoup after the war, but it failed to recover fully. It has been in a slow decline ever since. Its orchards and fields, its agrarian economy, were never fully restored. It ceased to be self-sufficient, economically, and its young men and women had to leave and go elsewhere. The once thriving village, which had 500 people before the war, has only 70 people now, all elderly or retired. There are no longer any children, and there are few working adults. The once vital town is depopulated and dying. All of Franco's paintings represent Pontito and his life there prior to 1943. They are all recollections of his childhood, of the place where he lived and played and grew up, before his father was killed, before the Germans came, before the occupation of the village and the ruination of its fields. Franco lived in Pontito until he was 12 in 1946, when he went to school in Lucca. In 1949, he went on to Montepulciano as an apprentice furniture maker. He was remarkable for his photographic memory even before this, as were his mother and one of his sisters to a lesser degree. He could remember a page after a single reading or the lesson in church after a single hearing. He could remember all the inscriptions on the gravestones in the cemetery. He could remember and add up long lists of figures at a glance. But it was only in Lucca, away from home for the first time, and markedly homesick, that he started to experience another sort of memory. Images that darted suddenly into his mind. Images of great personal resonance and intensity, sharp with pleasure or pain. These images were quite different from the rote memory that had distinguished him thus far. They were involuntary and sudden, flashlike and imperative, hallucinatory almost in their sound, their texture, their smell, and their feel. This new kind of memory was, above all, experiential, or autobiographical. For every image came with its proper personal context and affect. Each image was a scene, a flashback from his life. He painfully missed Pontito, his sister told me. It was the church, the street, the fields that he would see. But as yet, he had no impulse to draw. Franco returned to Pontito in 1953, after his 4 years of apprenticeship, but found that the village, already declining, could not support a woodworker. Unable to make a living in Pontito, or follow his trade, he went to Rapallo, where he worked as a cook, though he remained dissatisfied and dreamed of a different life in faraway places. At the start of 1960, he was now 25, he decided, half impulsively, half deliberately, to quit his job, to see the world, to work as a cook on a cruise ship. And as he was preparing to do this, knowing perhaps that he would never return, he composed an autobiography, but he flung it into the water as he was boarding the ship. The need to recollect, to make a picture of his childhood, was clearly very strong in him at this point. But he had not yet found his medium. So he set sail. He plied to and fro between the Caribbean and Europe, and got to know Haiti, the Antilles, and the Bahamas well. Indeed, in 1963 and 64, he spent 14 months in Nassau. During this time, he says he forgot Bontito. Thoughts of it almost never came to his mind. In 1965, when he was 31, he made a momentous decision. He would not go back to Italy, not go back to Pontito. He would settle in America, in San Francisco. The decision was a difficult and troubling one. It threatened a separation, perhaps irrevocable, from all that he held most valuable and dear. His country, his language, his village, his family, the habits and traditions that had bound his people together for hundreds of years. But it promised, or seemed to promise, freedom, and perhaps wealth. A new life in a new country, a freedom to be himself, to be independent, such as he had tasted on board ship. His father, as a young man, had also gone to America, and was in business for a few years, but then languished and returned to Pontito. But with the troubling decision, a strange illness occurred, which finally brought him to a sanatorium. It is far from clear what the illness was. There was a crisis of decision and hope and fear. But there was also a high fever, weight loss, delirium, perhaps seizures. There was a suggestion of tuberculosis, of a psychosis, or of some neurological condition. It was never really resolved what was going on, and the nature of the illness remains a mystery. What is clear is that at the height of the illness, his brain, perhaps stimulated by excitement and fever, Franco started to have, nightly and all night, overwhelmingly vivid dreams. Every night he dreamed of Pontito. Not of his family, not of activities or events, but of the streets, the houses, the masonry, the stones. Dreams with the most microscopic, veridical detail. A detail beyond anything he could consciously remember. An intense, strange excitement possessed him in these dreams. A sense that something had just happened, or was about to. A sense of immense, portentous, yet enigmatic significance, accompanied by an insatiable yearning, bittersweet nostalgia. And when he awoke, it seemed to him he was not fully awake, for the dreams were still present, still before his inward eye, painting themselves on the bedclothes and the ceiling and the walls all around him, or standing on the floor like models, solid with exquisite detail. In the hospital, with these dreamlike images forcing themselves upon his consciousness and his will, a new feeling took hold of him, a sense that he was now being called. Though his powers of imagery had always been great, he had never seen images of such intensity before, images that suspended themselves like apparitions in the air and promised him a repossession of Pontito. Now they seemed to say to him, "Paint us. Make us real." What happened, one wonders, and Franco has never ceased to ask himself, in those days and nights in the hospital, that time of crisis, delirium, fever, seizures. Did he crack under the stress of his decision, undergo a Freudian splitting of the ego, and become from then on a sort of hypermnesic hysteric? Hysterics suffer mainly from reminiscences, Freud wrote. Did a split-off part of him seek to provide in memory or fantasy what he had cut himself off from, could no longer return to in reality? Were these dreams, these memory images, called up by him in response to a deep emotional need? Or were they forced on him by some strange physiological bombardment of the brain, a process that he, as a person, had nothing to do with, but could not help reacting to. Franco considered but rejected these medical possibilities and never allowed them to be properly explored, and moved instead to a more spiritual one. A gift, a destiny had been vouchsafed to him, he felt, and it was his task to obey, not to question. It was in this religious spirit, then, that Franco, after a brief struggle, accepted his visions and now dedicated himself to making them a palpable reality. Though he had scarcely painted or drawn before, he felt he could take a pen or brush and trace the outlines that hovered so clearly in the air before him, or projected themselves, as through a camera lucida, on the white walls of his room. Above all, in those first nights of crisis, there came to him images of the house where he was born, images impossibly beautiful, but with a menacing aspect, too. Franco's first Pontito painting, indeed, was of his house, a painting that, despite his lack of training, had a striking confidence and clarity of outline, and a strange, dark, emotional force. Franco himself was amazed by this painting, by the fact that he could paint, could express himself in this wonderful new way. Even now, a quarter of a century later, he remains amazed. "Fantastic," he says, "fantastic. How could I do it? And how could I have had the gift and not known it before?" He had occasionally, as a child, imagined himself as an artist, but that was a mere fancy, and he had never done more than play with a pen or a brush. Sketch a ship on a postcard, perhaps, or a Caribbean scene. He was also frightened by the power he now felt, a power that had seized him and taken him over, but that he could perhaps control and give voice to. And the voice of his paintings, his style, was there from the start, even, or especially, in the first paintings he did. "The first two paintings are quite different from the later ones," his friend Bob Miller said to me. "There's something ominous in them. You can see something deep and significant happening." That Franco did not start thinking obsessively of Pontito, did not dream day and night of Pontito, until this time, is corroborated by his brother-in-law, who did not see him between 1961 and 1987. Back in 61, Franco would talk about anything, he told me. He wasn't obsessed. He was normal. But when I saw him in 87, he seemed possessed. He constantly had visions of Pontito, and he wouldn't talk about anything else. Miller says, "His painting started in this crisis period. He was in the hospital, pretty near a mental breakdown, and the paintings seemed to be a sort of solution or cure. Sometimes," he says, "I have these memories, I have these dreams, I can't function, but he seems to function pretty well. It's hard to have a normal conversation with him, though. It's Pontito, Pontito, Pontito all the time. It's as if he had this 3D construct, this model of Pontito he can erect. He moves his head, turns around to see different aspects. He seemed to think this sort of seeing was normal. And it was only in the late 70s when Gigi, a friend, came back with photos of Pontito that he realized for the first time how extraordinary it was. Everything is fresh, excited, as if just recalled. It is not a fixed thing, a repertorial thing at all. He remembers scenes, he acts them out, relives the whole thing. So it is a very concrete, particular memory which organizes itself in stories and scenes, a memory of who said what when. One sometimes feels that there is something theatrical in the paintings, and to some extent, Franco himself sees them that way. The mood that had announced itself in dreams at night now deepened and intensified in Franco's mind. He started to get visions of Pontito by day, visions emotionally overwhelming but with a minute and three-dimensional quality that he compares to holography. These visions may come at any time, when he is eating or drinking, taking a stroll, showering. There is no doubt of their reality for him. He is perhaps talking with you quietly, and suddenly he leans forward, his eyes fixed and staring in a rapture. An apparition of Pontito is rising before him. Many of Franco's paintings, writes Michael Pierce, in a fascinating analysis that appeared in the Exploratorium Quarterly to coincide with the exhibition, begin with what he describes as a kind of memory flash, where a particular scene will suddenly come into his head. He often feels a great urgency to get the scene down on paper immediately, and has been known to leave a bar in mid-drink in order to begin a sketch. Apparently, the flash Franco gets of a scene is not a static, photographic view. He can scan the area and see in several directions. To do this, he must physically reorient his body, turning to the right to envision what would be to the right in the Pontedon scene, to the left to see to that side, his eyes looking into the distance as though he can see the stone buildings and archways and streets. Such apparitions are not only visual. Franco can hear the church bells, like I was there. He can feel the churchyard wall, and above all, he can smell what he sees, the ivy on the church wall, the mingled smells of incense, must, and damp, and admixed with these, the faint smell of the nut and olive groves that grew around the Pontito of his youth. Sight, sound, touch, smell, at such times, are almost inseparable for Franco. And what comes to him is like the complex and synesthetic experiences of early childhood, the instantaneous records of total situations, the psychiatrist Harry Stack Sullivan once called them. It seems likely that there is some sudden and profound change in Franco's brain whenever he is inspired or possessed. Certainly when I first saw Franco seized by a vision and noted his staring eyes, his dilated pupils, his raptus of attention, I could not help wondering whether he was having a sort of psychic seizure. Such psychic seizures were first recognized a century ago by the great neurologist John Hewlings Jackson, who stressed the commanding hallucinations, the flow of involuntary reminiscence, the sense of revelation, and the strange, half-mystical, dreamy state that could be characteristic of these. Such seizures are associated with epileptic activity in the temporal lobes of the brain. In the last century, Hewlings Jackson, among others, suspected that some patients with frequent psychical seizures might show strange alterations in thinking and personality with the onset of their disorder. But it was not until the 1950s and 1960s that such an interictal personality syndrome, as it came to be called, received closer attention. In 1956, the French neurologist Henri Gastaut wrote an important memoir on Van Gogh, in which he presented the case for Van Gogh having not only temporal lobe seizures, but a characteristic personality change with the onset of these, gradually intensifying for the rest of his life. In 1961, one of the most gifted of American neurologists, Norman Geschwind, spoke about the possible role of temporal lobe epilepsy in Dostoevsky's life and writings, and by the early 70s had become convinced that a number of patients with TLE showed a peculiar intensification